Hello, my friends. This is Sarah from Weird Horizon, where we explore topics on the spooky, the esoteric, the countercultural, and just plain weird. Today, we are going to be continuing our series on the history of the vampire and its long lineage as a mutable, adaptive symbol against which we can define our own humanness. Last week we spoke about the body and the blood at the centre of the vampire, and how they interacted with the science, politics, religion and medicine of the time. Body and blood as metaphor were and still are highly charged symbols which the figure engaged with, thus becoming a well-known idea and often referenced at the cutting edge of societal debate. But the vampire at this point was primarily a monstrous creature. It was the literary treatments of the vampire which would give it its enduring personality and make it a truly timeless figure. And that is where we are going to begin this week. As always, for a brief rundown on the sources I've used in this series, I tackle that in length in the intro to the first episode, so please head there if you're interested in hearing about the sources used in this. But I will add on a few more that were of particular use in this episode, specifically being James Twitchell's The Vampire Myth and Richard Schweitzer's Lord Ruthven and the Vampires, both accessed on JSTOR. But for now, let's get on with it. So we arrive at the point the vampire as a figure of folklore is pretty well established, and many of its broader themes and metaphorical significance has been sketched out by the interaction between how we view the figure, how we view ourselves, and the world around us. The vampire of the Enlightenment took the many disparate folkloric vampires and vampire-like creatures and distilled them into a transmutable modern figure. Furthermore, the massive enduring success of Bram Stoker's Dracula gave the vampire a drive and personality, a humanity that ensured that the figure of the vampire would survive and adapt with the changing world as a literary figure. Many of the complicated questions around faith, the definition of life, the health of society, etc., that became entangled with the figure of the vampire are cleverly explored in the novel. But Dracula did not appear in a vacuum. It was part of an already existing vampire mythology, and what's more, as we're going to be exploring today, was not the first literary vampire. Today we will be looking at some of the vampire literature pre-Dracula, and exploring how they may have influenced Dracula and what the vampire was to become. As Jane Twitchell notes in The Vampire Myth, prior to the Romantic movement, the vampire existed in folklore and ecclesiastical study, but had no substantial literary presence. Then an explosion in German, French, and English writing catapulted it to the status at which point it became a potent metaphor for exploring our own humanity. The bulk of said writing came from the countries and in the languages in which the viral folkloric vampire cases were shared and widely talked about. Thus, this symbol was carried into the literary movements of the era, primarily the Romantic and Gothic movements. So briefly, the Romanticism movement was a literary and intellectual movement of the late 18th century in Europe. In part a reaction to the Age of Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, Romanticism turned the eye inward toward personal emotional experiences and tended to hark back to a simpler, often classical time, with the focus on aesthetics and the individual that came with said classical ideas. Another major theme in Romanticism works is transcendentalism, the strive for a unity with nature through which one can nurture one's own soul and form improved spiritual connections. It turned away from the broad changes of the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment and the increasingly mechanized world and the view of the human body as a part of a larger body of people, i.e. the urge to scientifically explain as much of the world around us as possible to interrupt the so-called natural order. In reaction to all this, Romanticism sought to sketch out a way a person might navigate this world and find fulfillment and peace. The related Gothic literary movement tended to explore the darker realities of this situation, exploring in more detail the limitations of man and the horror at the root of so-called supernatural occurrences. The two are connected and intertwined, but would both find in the vampire a lot to talk about. To quote Tritchell again, "For the Romantic artist, acutely self-conscious, found in this myth an analogy to explain how energy, life, imagination, creativity was exchanged between the various characters and activities he encountered." And to quote Groom in The Vampire: A New History, "The cult of the vampire thrived within the emerging Gothic, as figure was a perpetual and literal reminder that the past cannot be laid to rest, but will forever haunt the present." Let's have a look now at some pre-Dracula vampires, but we will have to, of course, be limited in scope to the more major works. Heinrich August Ostenfelder's poem Der Vampire, published 1748, contains a vampire in name and behaviour, speaking of a seemingly obsessive love, capable of traversing the threshold between life and death. I'll treat you to my terrible poetry reading voice now. "And as softly thou art sleeping, to thee shall I come creeping, and thy life's blood drain away. And so shalt thou be trembling, for thus shall I be kissing, and death's threshold though it crossing, with fear in my cold arms." This trembling nighttime visitation, intertwining love, sexual desire, and death, would be one of the most tantalizing and enduring staples of vampire writing. Although vampire writing almost most likely didn't originate here, it almost definitely owes a debt to Robert Southey's epic poem Thalaba the Destroyer. It would become a staple in the emerging vampire genre. Now, sticking with German poetry, Lenore, published in 1774 by Gottfried August Berger, is a widely republished and translated Gothic ballad in which a character returns from the grave. Although generally not considered a true vampire, Lenore was hugely influential in Gothic literature and what would evolve to be the Gothic vampire. The ballad is based on other pre-existing folk ballads of lovers returning to their beloved by night after their passing, such as the English folk ballad The Suffolk Miracle, where a young man returns to visit his beloved by night, only for her to discover in the morning him having passed on. In Lenore, William or Wilhelm, fiancé of Lenore, has not returned from the Seven Years' War. She then quarrels with God over the injustice of other people's loved ones returning, but not hers. Lenore is then visited by a mysterious man in the night, with an uncanny resemblance to William. She then accompanies him on a midnight horseback ride at superhuman speed. On questioning this, he replies as to the source of their speed, to quote, "the dead travel fast." This phrase was explicitly referenced in Dracula by Stoker for its myriad of nested meanings. One of Jonathan Harker's superstitious travelling companions whispers the phrase as they approach Dracula's castle. In this case, we can find reference to the unnatural journey of the dead between the worlds of the living and the dead, but also a hint at the transmissibility of legends around the dead and reanimated, as well as the humanist effects of war. Many are also quick to point out the murky origins of the phrase, being an interpretive translation from the German, and its spread as a literary device through drama and literature alike, at, in its own way, superhuman speed. At sunrise, William and Lenore arrive at a cemetery. As they pass through the tombstones, the knight loses his human appearance and is revealed to be death incarnate. The real William lies in his grave. The ground begins to crumble and spirits surround Lenore, declaring, "No one is to quarrel with God in heaven," where she promptly dies for her sin of disagreeing with God. On the many translations and interpretations of Lenore, I will be referencing Greg Walter Wilson's English translations of Lenore here. For instance, He explains, the question of whether this spectral ghost truly is William is unanswered in the text and became a point of contention in many of the English translations. As mentioned, treating him as William fit in with the existing canon of English folk ballads, and Lenore was also translated as Eleanor, Helen, Leonora, etc., all to fit into the existing popular ballad style. As you may have gathered, like vampire tales, translators took the chance to translate Lenore and twist it to their own ideological means. For example, in Wilson's words, the first would seem to be that by J.T. Stanley, who is remarkable chiefly for his interest in the cause of religion and morality. The retribution dealt out by Berger to the unhappy girl seemed to him inconsistent with our ideas of a just and benevolent deity, and he consequently made alterations in his later version. In Stanley's version, at the end of the poem, Lenore repents and awakes from her dream, somewhat in contrast to a lot of other folk ballads, where often evidence of the visit persists by leaving physical effects in the real world. They are often dreamlike, but are not just dreams. What's more, William also lives in Stanley's version, completely negating the point of the poem, many would argue. But many translations were seemingly more faithful and kept the poem open to various interpretations, creating fertile ground for influence and expansion. As a result, many tout Lenore as instrumental in the founding of Romantic literature in Europe and Gothic literature to follow it. Those influenced by it include Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Percy Shelley, John Keats, William Wordsworth, and of course, Bram Stoker. One more poem before we move on to novels and novellas. We will touch on Byron's The Gower, published in 1813. Now, the word Gower is an offensive word from infidel picked up by Byron on his Turkish tour. And the poem is designed to contrast English and Turkish ideas around love, death, and the afterlife. The fragment, in Byron's words, is based on a Turkish tale. So famous for one of the first written depictions of vampires, the Gower will be condemned to become a vampire after his death and kill his own family by sucking their blood to his own frightful torment as well as theirs. Thus, the vampire in Byron's treatment has somewhat more in common with folkloric tales than with the supernatural ballads preceding it. The vampire in the Gower is doomed by its compulsion to feed specifically upon its loved ones. And I'll read a fragment from it now. But first on earth as vampire sent, thy corpse shall from its tomb be rent, then ghastly haunt thy native place, and suck the blood of all thy race. There from thy daughter, sister, wife, at midnight drain the stream of life, yet loathe the banquet which perforce must feed thy livid living corpse. Thy victims ere yea that expire shall know the demon for their sire, as cursing thee, thou cursing them, thy flowers are withered on the stem. So the vampirism and the familiar connection somewhat lost from much of the folklore is made clear here. But unlike other folkloric tales where family members and neighbours were struck down irrespective of gender, the Gower has a particular focus on women as victims, daughters, sisters, wives, etc. Thus, not only does the poem paint vampirism as a corruption of familial love, but also heterosexual relationships, a thread which many would expand on in future works, the supposed natural weakness of women to resist the vampire being rolled up in the sort of growing mythos of the vampire and becoming one of its more central tenets. What's more, the final couplet, as cursing thee, thou cursing them, thy flowers are withered on the stem, holds a myriad of associations which would come to become staples of the genre in their own right as well. Cursing thee, thou cursing them, stresses this curse which works both ways, the victims and the vampire being both similarly condemned. And thy flowers are withered on the stem, again stresses the unnatural nature of this living death. The withered flower is an emblem for the corruption of creation and growth and the end of natural procreation. But it also carries with it an association with the young woman, the blooming flower, as a natural victim for the vampire. Now, Lord Byron himself is to this day somewhat of a difficult figure, with many, including close family, remarking on his many successive, sudden and compulsive loves. He described in his own words even his earliest attractions as so violent that I sometimes doubt if I have ever been really attached since. Now, this obsessive, all-consuming love would come to be associated with the vampire, in no small part, it seems, due to his proximity in the foundation of the vampire canon. So we will talk more about this when we talk of Polidori's The Vampire, but I think it is fair to say that there has been an influence on the founding literary vampire by the proximity of Byron as a figure. So Byron as a literary figure and celebrity loved people of all genders fiercely, but was often criticised for his attraction to his young cousins and the corrupting influence his love had on the lives of the object of his affection. As such, literary pastiches of Byron were common and often conflated with circulating literary vampires, and you can argue entangling Byron with the idea of the vampire in its inception as this kind of rich, charming, proud, unstable, dangerous to know, yet enchanting figure. Now, sticking with Byron, the story goes that in an unseasonably wet June in 1816, in Villa Diodati, Lake Geneva, Lord Byron, Dr. John William Polidori, Percy Shelley, and future wife Mary Godwin, or Mary Shelley, and Mary's stepsister Claire Claremont were trapped inside for 3 days and challenged each other to produce fantastical stories. From this challenge, Mary would produce what would become Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus, Polidori would produce The Vampire, and Byron produced his own vampire-inspired fragment. And it is the most enduring that we will briefly touch on now, being Frankenstein, with how it included the vampire as a literary device. Now, Frankenstein, first published in 1818, of course has at its centre a form of reanimated dead, although in Shelley's work, the creature is of course made of many dead, not one, to become its own creature. Nevertheless, the focus on the work is less on the monstrous nature of the creature, but more on how it relates to the world. In Dr. Frankenstein's mistreatment of his creature and subsequent death of many of those around him, he describes him, to quote, nearly in the light of my own vampire, my own spirit let loose from the grave and forced to destroy all that was dear to me. So obviously there are some pretty clear echoes from previous folkloric tales that we've talked about and also Byron's The Gower in this specific familial compulsion to destroy all that is close to one. But one of the most interesting ways in which Frankenstein, the novel, engages with the modern vampire as product of the Enlightenment is that the creature is a product of cutting-edge medical science. As in the year of the first publication of Frankenstein being 1818, James Blundell announced results of his first dog blood transfusions and a move to human testing. So the creature's blood in the novel Frankenstein is animal, not human. And this also complicates his view of himself as human, as self-aware and logical, yet in this innate way, his lifeblood is animal. So this, of course, engages with Descartes' question in Discourse on Method as to whether a creature in material likeness to a person is a person. And what's more, the creature's cremation of himself at the close of the novel echoes the disposal of many historical vampire corpses and highlights that although the creature in Frankenstein cannot be considered a true vampire, it tackles many of the same themes as the vampires that follow it. But let's move on for now to another major work stemming from Villa Diodati, being Dr. John William Polidori's The Vampire. Published in 1819, The Vampire focuses on a portrait of the vampire Lord Ruthven, a sexual delinquent and predator based on his former friend and employer, Lord Byron. Groom in The Vampire: A New History comments on Polidori thus turning the vampire into a Byronic anti-hero. In a way, we can see the Byronic and vampiric characters overlapping and blending. Within romantic literary circles, the Byronic figure and the vampire figure for a time seem to be equally irresistible as instantly recognisable figures of fear and charming perversion. The name Lord Ruthven itself seems to derive from another novel by Lady Caroline Lamb, the 1816 Glenarvan, being once again based on an unflattering depiction of her former lover, Lord Byron. This novel, although having some gothic and supernatural elements, doesn't have much crossover with the vampire, yet the figure/character was picked up by many other authors rewriting the vampire tales that had come before with varying success, such as Charles Nodier, Polidori, Lamb, and even Alexandre Dumas, albeit in dramatic rather than novel form. So Lord Ruthven in The Vampire is described as a cruel and calculating privileged man. Yet despite his seeming privilege, there is a desperate jealousy at the centre, wishing to corrupt those around him. To quote, "A nobleman more remarkable for his singularities than his rank, he gazed upon the mirth around him as if he could not participate therein. Apparently, the light laughter of the fair only attracted his attention, that he might by a look quell it and throw fear into those breasts where thoughtlessness reigned." The figure, seeming to have it all, lives parallel to a world whose quality he covets, appearing to exhibit love, but being eluded by it. So the idea of the look of the vampire, of death as catching, stemming from the earliest vampire tales surrounded by sort of plague tellings, Polidori complicates this idea with Ruthven's life-sucking look. Although not physically draining life, although to be clear, later in the novel, Ruthven does physically suck people's lifeblood in this tale, he appears able to also suck joy with his very look. To quote, "His glance fell upon the cheek with a leaden ray that weighed upon the skin it could not pass. When she stood before him, though his eyes were apparently fixed on hers, still it seemed as if they were unperceived." And interestingly, it is Ruthven's inability to participate in the exchange of vitality and emotion through personal relationships that potentially motivates his compulsion to suck what he can from the living, being their blood. Our protagonist, a young orphan named Aubrey, falls in with the Lord Ruthven. Described as having poetic heart and sentiment, Aubrey is attached to the romance of his solitary hours. He was startled to find there was no foundation in real life for any of that congeries of pleasing pictures and descriptions contained in those volumes. Disenchanted with the world, Aubrey is about to give up on his dreams and his romantic view on life when he meets Lord Ruthven, who exploits his romantic leanings and lures him in with his treacherous beauty. He soon formed this object into the hero of a romance, and determined to observe the offspring of his fancy rather than the person before him. It is this desire to see the Lord Ruthven for what he wanted him to be, rather than what he was, that allows their relationship to continue as far as it does. And Frankenstein-like, his desire to mould the world around him to his desires leads to tragic ends. Once again, in this tale, we see this indication of the curse of vampirism having to work both ways, and enduring vampire tales showing this curse kind of working both ways. The two nevertheless decide to go on a European tour together as a rite of passage for the young Aubrey, as was expected of men of their ranks at that time. Now, Lord Ruthven at all times remains a creature of contrast and contradiction. Aubrey describes him as, to quote, profuse in his liberality. He indulges those who ask for charity of him only when he knows that it will hurt them. Perhaps as a reflection of Ruthven's own self-destructive compulsions, he would reward the similarly destructive. I'll share a longer passage now, slightly abridged. If the profligate came to ask something, not to relieve his wants, but to allow him to wallow in his lust, or to sink him still deeper in his inquiry, he was sent away with rich charity. All those upon whom it was bestowed inevitably found that there was a curse upon it, for they were all either led to the scaffold or sunk to the lowest and most abject misery. He had required to enhance his gratification that his victims, the partner of his guilt, should be hurled from the pinnacle of unsullied virtue down to the lowest abyss of infamy and degradation. In this way, and like Carmilla after him, he is described, when it comes to his potential to cause suffering, as an epicure. The harm he causes is a curse, but not simply a curse, but a compulsion and a desire to cause hurt. Thus, for me, Polidori's Ruthven, I think, forms one of the most complicated but also driven vampire figures before Dracula. And many aspects of said character would be taken up in later literary vampires, especially as the Romantic period came to an end and the privilege and more aesthetic elements of the movement began to draw increasing criticism. After Aubrey eventually comes to see Ruthven for the monster that he truly is, he leaves him and travels on alone to Greece, where he meets Ianthe. Through her, he makes a connection between Ruthven as a horrible person to the vampires of folklore and begins to suspect him as superhuman. Ianthe is promptly murdered by Ruthven as he closes back in on Aubrey, insinuating himself into his life as caregiver to Aubrey while simultaneously being the cause of his illness and mental breakdown. Again, these themes of protracted sickness and care will be carried into many vampire tales, as the image of the helpless ill struck low in their bed was just too potent of a symbol to resist, in contrast to this hyper-powerful and incorruptible undead vampire. After being attacked by bandits, Ruthven appears to die, but not before making Aubrey promise not to reveal his true nature as a vampire until 1 year after his death. He, of course, returns from the dead and uses Aubrey's oath against him, seducing Aubrey's sister and murdering her on their wedding night. Aubrey is powerless to say anything, and in the grips of a nervous breakdown, haunted by the knowledge of Ruthven's many murders and compulsion to kill any innocents who cross his path, Ruthven disappears into the world to haunt someone else's life. Thus, to quote from Polidori in context from the Palgrave Handbook of the Vampire, John William Polidori unleashes the figure of the vampire in all its aristocratic and privileged, rhetorically powerful and seductive, sexually potent and corruptive, and in any case, cunning and elusive power. Apologies, but we'll have to leave it here for now in our treatment of the literary vampire. Next week, we will talk about Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla and Bram Stoker's Dracula in more detail. In these literary examples, we can see the general idea of the vampire being explored as a source of fear. Often what makes a literary vampire scary is their ability to manipulate or trick those close to them into believing them alive, and the often romantic affection they display being a trap, luring in the unsuspecting. These vampires are often associated with the wealthy and the lifestyles of the wealthy, stalking sumptuous bedrooms and haunting those laid low by weakness or illness. To have a vampire enter into your life is a curse, resulting in the corruption of romantic and familial love, ensnared by the coldly calculated game of the vampire. We will be back next week to talk about the myriad of other ways the vampire was expanded upon in Carmilla and Dracula, two works which solidified the figure of the vampire into a more solid archetype. In the meantime, you can find me wherever you consume your podcasts, and you can chat with me on X as Weird Horizon and on Instagram as Weird Horizon Podcast. Older episodes are slowly being added to YouTube, so if that's how you prefer to listen, they are coming and should all be up in the next couple of months. I would also like to take the opportunity to highlight another podcast out there that I think you guys should check out. So Fire Breathing Kittens is an actual play one-shot podcast that plays various tabletop role-playing games with a season-long plot. Because there's a beginning and an end to each week's story, you can start at any episode. Every week has a different combination of four people from the same rotating cast group of people. Join Fire Breathing Kittens as they solve detective mysteries, attempt comedic banter, and enjoy friendship. So if you like other long-form content and want something a little bit more relaxed, please check them out. They are very cool. I've listened to some of their episodes as well, and I think you would really dig them. But for now, as always, bye.